You're listening to My Unlived Life, a podcast about the path not taken. I'm Miriam Robinson. A few years ago, my life fell apart in pretty dramatic fashion, and I found myself feeling that somewhere I'd made a wrong turn. I suddenly felt very far from home and family, and felt even farther from myself. I began to wonder, what if I had done things differently? We don't like to ask this question. It threatens to trap us in the past, without a map back to the here and now. So I decided to make the map. Each episode, I interview someone about another course their lives could have taken. We begin at the point where their paths diverged, and together, step by step, we imagine ourselves into the lives they never lived. Because these lives have a lot to teach us about ourselves, if we let them. For this episode, I spoke to Vanessa Walters. Vanessa has a background in international journalism and playwriting, and is a Tin House and Malay arts resident. She is the author of two previous YA books, and film rights for her novel, The Lagos Wife, have been optioned by HBO. Born and raised in London, she currently lives in Brooklyn, and The Lagos Wife, which we're discussing today, is out now and can be found in your local bookshop. When we spoke, Vanessa and I talked about what her life might have looked like if she hadn't gotten married at the age of 30 and moved with her husband to Lagos, the setting of her incredible novel, and had instead moved to LA to pursue a dream of screenwriting. Along the way, we discussed the way place can change you, ways to change your life, step by tiny step, and how the women of Selling Sunset managed to sell houses in those ridiculous stilettos. Hi, Vanessa.
Hey, Miriam. Pleased to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me on My Unlived Life. I'm so pleased that you're here. You have an amazing, I love your coffee mug. Before we do anything else, it's just very elegant. Feels crucial on a Friday morning. I'm so looking forward to speaking to you about your unlived life because it dovetails so nicely with your book, your new novel, The Lagos Wife, that I'm really, really looking forward to kind of seeing sort of where we go and what we can learn about the motivations and the actual life that went into the creation of your book. So I was hoping before we got started, you could just say a little bit about the novel.
Sure. Well, The Lagos Wife is set in Lagos, Nigeria. It's about a woman called Nicole who is married to a wealthy Nigerian man. She's from the UK originally. And at the beginning of the novel, she disappears. And her aunt comes to Lagos to find her. And the search throws up all sorts of questions about Nicole's past life and what she's been doing in Lagos, sort of what she's really been doing. And also the aunt herself, like, throws up a lot of questions for the aunt herself. So it's told from two perspectives, from Nicole's perspective before the disappearance and from the aunt's perspective while looking for her.
And that joint perspective is so beautifully done. And the way you toggle between the before and the after, you know, Nicole's life and then her aunt looking for her, back forth. Did you conceive it that way originally? Did you always know that you wanted to have two perspectives?
No, not at all. I started kind of, you know, as we've discussed before, Miriam, this is very much inspired by my former life in Lagos. I lived in Lagos for 7 years, and I was also married to a Nigerian man, and I'm from the UK. And I was really writing to a lot of questions I had about that experience. So initially, I think the novel was really almost more sort of like a memoir, like asking questions about the experience. And then I quickly got bored of writing about myself. It wasn't so easy for me to interrogate the experience as me. So I had to create like a fictional character that I could sort of turn 360 degrees and look at objectively and use that character to probe the life in Lagos. Enter Nicole. And then I sort of felt like even that was not enough to interrogate the experience, because Nicole, when you meet her in the novel, has been living in Lagos for a number of years. So she can't sort of be surprised at everything that's happening. She's become a Lagosian in so many ways. And that's one of my big points in the novel, is that Lagos does change you. It changes everyone. So enter a new person, somebody who could come into Lagos and be sort of saying ridiculous things about what they find, as any stranger would when they come into a new place, like, oh, isn't it hot? And, oh, you know, well, this is different. So that's really how I came up with Claudine, the aunt, someone who could come into Lagos and interrogate this place with different eyes. And also someone who could really critique Nicole from knowing about her former life. So the aunt also is sort of the backstory coming in to the novel in quite an active way. And it worked really well. It actually spoke to so many things I wanted to ask about sort of Caribbean, British Caribbean history and Caribbean history. And it took me on such a wonderful journey of researching that and talking to extended family members about what their lives were like as children and what their lives were like in Jamaica before. And it gave the novel such a lovely extra layer to it.
I love that as a device for introducing backstory, that second character, because I think that's something so many writers struggle with, isn't it? Is how do you sort of fluidly and seamlessly introduce backstory? And you're right, Claudine does that really perfectly. And also, I guess, what we're about to do today, in a way, is a bit of a, how to put this? This sounds almost brutally, but we're almost going to split you into two characters to a certain extent, right? We've got your life and we're going to hear about your life. And what we're going to do is we're going to branch off and we're going to find a different life, a different possibility of what your life might have been like. So I'll be really interested to see what we find as we investigate it. So can you, we've got a path, we're set, we're ready to go. Can you first just give us a little bit of context? So around the time of the path that we're going to discuss, how old are you? Where are you living? What's your life like?
Okay. I'm living in the UK. I've just hit 30. The big 30. I suppose I'm Black British, so I'm in a kind of mixed community of Caribbeans and West Africans, as well as my other friends. But I think that's sort of my core community in the UK. I work in media. I write for a Black women's magazine. I also do some work for a radio program called Colorful Radio, which represents people of color. And I'm born and raised in London. And yeah, I write as well. I think that I've just come off the back of, oh no, I still am the writer in residence for Kensington and Chelsea. And my brief is to research the Black historical presence in London. So I'm writing a book called Smoke Othello, and I'm writing a play called Michael X about a Black British civil rights guy, historical figure from the 60s, who had a shady side to him. So that's, you know, that's what I'm doing at the time when this pivotal moment takes place.
Thank you. That gives a very, very good picture. And so, okay. Now, and there's something on your mind, right? Everything's good. You've got a lot going on. Your career is blossoming. You're obviously really sort of active, but you've got an anxiety. You've got a worry about a pressing thing that you think you need to do. What is that?
I was raised in quite a traditional way, you know, raised in the church, and also, my family are pretty conservative. So I felt like when I was 30, it's almost like a switch turning on that it's time to get married. I think it's somewhat ironic in a way that that thought came to me with so much clarity, because I've always been very much a self-starter. I went to a feminist school. It's a school in London called Queen's College School for Girls, started by two suffragettes, and it always had a very feminist ethos. I'd always been super independent and worked very hard, and obviously pursuing a creative field like writing as a woman is kind of feminist anyway, because, you know, it was still at a time when I think women were still sort of establishing themselves in as writers, as directors, as, you know, creators. So to suddenly have that moment, I think, is kind of interesting. But I did, and I didn't really question it. It just sort of was like, okay, so yeah, it's time to get married. And I always did want to have a family and be a mother. That was always a dream of mine. But it's still, I suppose, something I reflect on today. I took a very sort of traditional path at that time. And what would have happened if I hadn't?
Well, that's what we're going to figure out. But tell us quickly what did happen. So you basically looked for husband material, right? You sort of, yeah. And you found one.
And
the husband store.
Yeah, I actually met my husband on Match.com. So, you know, online dating at that time as well was very intentional because it was still new enough so that a lot of people were not even really thinking about dating online. Whereas now people, it's more sort of default that you want to date someone, you download one of these apps, Hinge or whatever. So I think I was very intentional about it. And I met my husband, and I think he was in a very intentional space as well, because 6 months later he proposed and I accepted. Wow. And then our life together kind of began. I mean, I was a bit hesitant. So though I accepted his proposal, I did then take a job in Paris. So I had some time to like think about it. I was in Paris then for at least 6 months. And then I thought, okay, let's do this. And I moved to Indonesia with him for a year. And then after that, we got married.
And then soon after that, you moved to Lagos with him. Is that right?
Yeah, about a year after we got married, I had just had my first child. And I was presented with the question, let's move to Lagos. And that's very similar to the book as well, because that happens to Nicole, that moment. And I think it is an interesting moment. I think for all sort of the foreign wives who live in Lagos, is like, what made you move to Lagos? Because it's not a place you would naturally think of moving to if you have grown up in almost anywhere else in the world, because it's a place which I think is sort of plagued by negative preconceptions. It's a place which is sort of known to not have, you know, the same level of infrastructure, the same level of a cosmopolitan experience as somewhere like New York or London. Everyone wants to live in New York, London, Paris, Tokyo. But when you say I moved to Lagos, people sort of say, well, why would you do that? And so I think there is always a moment that women like myself who did move to Lagos have as why did they move? And for the women like myself, Nicole, and other Lagos wives, they're actually called Niger wives in the book. That's like an immigration term for the foreign wife of a Nigerian man who lives in Lagos. So for all of these Niger wives, I think there is a moment in their minds of why they did it. And for most of us, it's because of a man. Not all. Some Niger wives made their own way to Lagos. And I think their stories are really interesting. They were looking at business opportunities, or perhaps they were working in sort of the Peace Corps or other sort of NGOs that were doing work in Lagos. But for most Niger wives, their husbands brought them to Lagos from somewhere else.
And you describe really beautifully in the book this sort of group of them who all, because in part because they've all come from all these different places, have no family, they've uprooted, have a sort of community of each other where everybody gets together, they have meetings, they support each other, which I just found fascinating.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing I realized when writing the book, because at the time I wrote it initially, I didn't think about it like that. Mm. You know, that was just my life. And I was more writing about Lagos, this amazing city, and what it's like to live there. But then I think by the end, or sort of halfway through the book, when I had moved away from Lagos, but was still writing the book, so had that distance, I realized that actually it's a shared experience, that what Nicole went through, what I went through, a lot of Niger wives go through. And it's sort of inevitable that you are going to have all these questions. Do I belong in this place? How do I make a life here in a place that's so different to where I came from? And how has this place changed me? So who am I now? Have I lost myself? How strong is my relationship? Because when you're there for a man and then you're totally dependent on that man, you're going to think about that relationship a whole lot. Who are my friends here? Who are the people who I can really rely on if something terrible happens? And so I was really pleased that after the book came out, initially it came out in the US in 2023, the Niger wives really embraced it, and they have actually used it as a discussion book to kind of probe what they are to each other and how they can best support each other. You know, I think there's an extra importance to the Niger Wives Association, and the book helped them recognize that.
Okay, well, I think we're going to get more into what your experience was actually like in Lagos and what Nicole's experience was, but let's get you on your path, shall we?
Sure.
Okay. Let's play the game. Okay, so we're going back to, you're 30 years old, you're writing, you're working for your radio station, you're doing a play. You decide not to go on Match.com, right? You don't go hunting for a husband because actually you're like, yeah, I'm fine as I am.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah. So I think, yeah, I think the first thing that I can say would definitely have happened is I would have written more.
Okay.
Because I think that, and this is with hindsight, you know, reflecting on what it means to be a writer. Now I'm back into writing, and now that it's a thing I really want to do and I've thrown myself into it completely now, I think back then, and partly it is to do with coming from a background where I was the first person in my family to go to university. I was the first person in my family to be a published author. I think I was the first person in my family, I can say, to really be academic and professionally intellectual in some way. My grandparents were illiterate when they came to the UK, or semi-literate, I would say. My grandfather definitely was illiterate. He taught himself to read and write when he arrived in the UK. And he has even showed me the dictionary, the Bible, and the encyclopedia he used to help himself read. And my mom remembers him crying in frustration because he couldn't read or write. My other grandfather, I think, was nearly illiterate, if not illiterate, because he used to, before he came to the UK, used to sell mangoes and clean planes in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So my parents both have been through school here, but they arrived at the age of 9 and they proceeded on to forms of higher education. But I think for me I wrote my first novel at 16, and and that was published. It was a YA book called Rude Girls. And so I think they really didn't know what to do with me in that way. They didn't know how to support me. And so I was really fumbling through my writer's journey. And so I think one of the things I didn't really have in mind at this pivotal moment of turning 30 and thinking about marriage was thinking about my writing career and how much time it takes to be a writer, and also thinking about what sort of writer I wanted to be. And now I think I'm very careful about my time because I understand how much work it is to write something important, and the pressure and what you have to give emotionally and where that comes from. So diving into married life totally took me away from writing in ways I sort of almost didn't notice.
So you don't remember feeling that you were missing something because you were so deeply into the early years of your marriage?
Yeah, I didn't really notice it. I was very happy. I wanted to be the perfect wife. I wanted to be the perfect mother. And I threw myself into that wholeheartedly, thinking there was some kind of pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. And
our kids definitely don't give us that pot of gold, do they? They just say, I said I wanted no crust on my sandwich.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that rainbow is infinite. I think there is a realization that you have to find your way back to yourself from being a wife and a mother. I think most women get to that point. Usually it is around the time when you've stopped having more children, like you're like, this is it. I think that's when you sort of start to realize, hey, what happened to my life and what happened to me? I'm just giving to everyone around me. And everyone just sort of has this expectation that that's what I do. And nobody's going to think of my life for me. You know, your children, not until they're much older, are they going to turn around and say, oh, well, Mum, what did you want to do with your life? And I think if I hadn't, I would definitely have written more. I was very productive at that time. I was working on plays and I was working on novels and I was extremely stimulated and I had a very exciting writing community that I was a part of. Okay. And I really took those people for granted. Because when I moved to Lagos, I was in sort of more like a Stepford Wife sort of community, not just the Niger Wives, but the circle I was in was very homogenous. It was very what we might think of as middle class. You've got the cook, the driver, the nanny, everybody has that. And you have to manage your household as a sort of boss. It's called a madame in Lagos. You're a madame now. You have your household to manage. Your whole sort of existence revolves around being a madame and planning your holidays for the year and planning everybody's needs. My husband became very problematic in a lot of ways when we moved to Nigeria because, as I said, Nigeria changes you. The patriarchy changes you and the pressures of life there change you. So I think men really experience something different there, as in they're on a pedestal. Being on that pedestal and maintaining that pedestal requires you to operate differently. So you have to, I'm the madame and he is the oga. So the oga is the big boss. Okay.
Okay.
So the big oga has to command respect. And he also can feel entitled to sort of anything he wants. within his resources. So, you know, my husband demanded not to have the same dish twice in 6 weeks.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That is giving me such a panic attack. I literally can make three things.
He was no longer allowed in his mind to push the stroller or wear the baby carrier or carry the children. You know, there's a level of entitlement which just becomes normalized very quickly. I remember being told off by my father-in-law because I asked my husband a question in public that he felt was intrusive. And I think the question was, how are things going at work?
Oh my God.
I was told off immediately in front of everyone that you're not to question your husband in public. And if he wants to tell you something about his work, he'll tell you. As long as your needs are provided for, you shouldn't have any questions for him anyway.
I think this really comes across in the book. It must have felt so scary and isolating to have this sort of 360, not just of your physical environment, but of your relationship. I mean, that's so dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, I think I came to find it scary and isolating. I think in the beginning, when it was all shiny and new, it was more fascinating and funny, if you see what I mean. But I think over time, it did get me down, and it did make me worry about those bigger questions of, am I really a full person here? And why? And then it affects your psyche, because as you're sort of marginalized in the real, in the outside world, in the exterior world, you marginalize yourself in your interior world. In your interiority, you deprioritize yourself. And I think after the years passed, I started to feel not myself. And it caused me to disassociate. And I would be sort of depressed, frankly, that I didn't feel like myself and I couldn't be myself and I wasn't allowed to ask questions and nobody sort of prioritized me. I mean, I think this is where Nigerian women, to a large extent, even though they will go through this, they do better because they have their family in Nigeria. So your family, your mother, your parents, your siblings will always prioritize you. You'll always be special to them. So you can leave your husband's house, as it's called, and go back to your father's house, as it's called, and be reaffirmed and validated and, you know, talk about what's happening. And your family will even advocate for you with your in-laws in terms of anything that you're going through. So you have people advocating for you. But with the Niger wives, you don't have anybody advocating for you. And I think that's where it becomes unhealthy.
Such an interesting just thought about kind of what family is for and what it does for you. A nice way of thinking about that, a sort of unit that advocates for you, which is ultimately what Claudine does for Nicole, right? I mean, that's what she's trying to do. Okay, well, let's give you a little bit of an experience where that doesn't happen in principle. So we're back here. You're not going for marriage. You're going to stay with your writing. You said you were already working on a novel. You're already working on a play. I have a question, which is, so 6 months into or after you agreed to get married, you got this job offer in Paris. Do you think you'd still get the job offer in Paris?
Yes. So it was after I got engaged that I got the job offer in Paris.
What was the job? Let's get.
It was a great job as well. So I was working for Thomson Reuters, and as a financial journalist. And I had worked in France before because I did French law and I studied that in Paris. So that was actually a great job for me. I was enjoying that job in Paris. I was enjoying being out of the UK for a while. And I had considered taking a similar job in Dubai, perhaps. A lot of my friends were taking jobs in Dubai because I think there was low tax. And it was a good way to, I think, especially if you were a person of color, to step outside of UK racism for a minute, the stuff that sort of holds you back and spread your wings.
And were you, can I ask, were you feeling that in the UK? Were you feeling UK
racism?
I
think I was on a subconscious level. I think when you're young, you perhaps you don't feel it quite so much. It's sort of when you look back, you realize that, oh, perhaps your advancement hasn't happened. Your opportunities haven't happened the way they should have happened or the way they happened for your white peers. It wasn't just color, it was class as well. I could only seem to get writing gigs for like very left-wing publications like The Guardian, The New Statesman. Those are where I got writing gigs. I couldn't seem to get writing gigs from places like The Times or The Telegraph or, you know, get a look in at somewhere like Marie Claire or Elle magazine. And these magazines were also spreading their wings into places like Dubai and further east. So that's where there was more opportunity for people of color to get those credits and get that those promotions and get to do more varied work. I was also thinking about screenwriting. I had written a screenplay around that time. And I was thinking of moving to LA and seeing how that went.
Okay, well, I think we should make a choice then. Is it going to be Dubai or LA? You've been in Paris for a bit. You've been working for Reuters. I love how you just kind of casually threw in that you studied French law. Oh, by the way, in addition to your writing and your screenwriting and all of these, like, you're amazing. But so yeah, what do you think it's going to be? Dubai or LA? Media or taking a stab at screenwriting?
I think ideally it would have been LA.
Okay.
Because I think the media was more about something that I sort of was a bit sort of career-based, that sort of made sense from a career point of view. But my real love was creative writing. And writing for TV still is a dream of mine. So hopefully I would have pursued the riskier dream of going to LA and trying to make it there as a screenwriter. My plays, I've had 4 or 5 plays staged in the UK. Nothing major. So the sort of like the small rooms at the theater, you know.
Still a room in a theater. It's good.
Still a room in a theater.
A small room.
So I definitely think once you've written a number of plays, writing for TV or film is a natural progression. And I think would have been really interesting to see what I would have done in LA.
Okay. Also, you said when we spoke earlier this week, you said a really lovely thing about feeling increasingly like the thing to do in life is to go where the energy is. And it feels like that. LA feels like it's where your energy would be taking you. Does that feel right?
Yeah. When I was at my lowest point, and that was sort of, I think when I was feeling very claustrophobic in my Lagos life, I decided that nothing made sense anymore. As in, I didn't know which way was up. I didn't really see a way that I could improve my life, as it were. Not that my life was terrible. I was very comfortable. I had two adorable children and, you know, still married. But everything was kind of not working for me. And nobody really wanted to hear that. My husband at the time was very, he's not a Tonya character at all, I should say.
It's worth pointing out. Tonya is not nice.
It's not a Tonya character at all. But I did put a couple of the things that he had said to me a little insensitively. One of the things he'd said was that you complain a lot, but nobody's going to feel sorry for you because you have so much. You have so much privilege in a country where, you know, half the country is like surviving on a dollar a day. You know, your whining is very entitled. And I felt very shut down. And I really did feel like, agree with him, that no one would really listen. So nothing really made sense to me because I still felt this way, even though I was trying to sort of suppress it. And I came up with this thing that I think sort of saved me, which was follow the energy, right? Go where the energy is and don't worry about it. Go wherever you can find a little bit of joy in your day, where something feels right to do. And don't worry if that thing, if things seems pointless. Right? Don't worry if it seems pointless. Don't worry if it turns out to be pointless or if it turns out to be harmful. You can step away from it, right? But commit to following the energy, the good energy. And so when I started writing, I was following the energy. I didn't know it was going to be a book. I didn't know if it was going to do anything good, but it felt good to write it. I started going out more because, again, I realized I'm actually pretty good at making friends. And I am. And when I'm with my friends, I have fun. And I need to have some fun. So I started being more sociable. Maybe the fun thing that day would be to do my hair. Maybe the fun thing that day would be to go to the supermarket and find something I really want to eat. That's not part of the 6-week rolling menu we have to have, but something spontaneous that I really want to eat, whether it's potato chips or whether it's, you know, something else. And through those little steps, I think I really found myself again. So that's something I really hold on to and which I encourage people to do if they're feeling lost or hopeless, is to not really try to fix the big picture of your life because that's overwhelming. You have to keep going by reducing perhaps the time frame. What can you do now that is going to bring a bit of joy into your life or going to make you feel a little bit purposeful or going to make you feel like you did something you really wanted to do? And focus on those things and be prepared to make mistakes, because I think that's how you find your way out of a hole, is by allowing yourself to make mistakes. I think that's part of getting back to who I was originally. I feel like where I am in my life right now is definitely thanks to trusting myself and trusting the things that bring me joy. And I have found myself again. So yeah, I think back then at that pivotal time, I would have followed the energy. You're right. I would have ended up in LA. And I would have done the screenwriting. And whether or not I became Shonda Rhimes or whoever else, or Oprah or whatnot, I think it would have been, you know, a super interesting phase of my life.
Well, why don't we lean into it a little bit and see if we can figure out if you're Shonda Rhimes or not? So I need some grounding in time. Where are we? Are we sort of early 2000s? No, 2010?
Yeah, I think it's like 2009, 2010.
Okay, fine. So it's 2010. You're 30, 31, because you've spent a little time in Paris now. You've come to LA to be a screenwriter. What is your kind of material circumstance? Are you renting somewhere? Do you need to find a roommate? Where are you living?
I think because my strategy was, because I had a lot of media and sort of administrative background, my plan was to take a low impact job as some sort of receptionist, admin work, whatever I could get, media if I could get it, and basically be writing around that, you know, after work. It's amazing being a mom now, realizing how much time I had before.
So. Isn't it incredible that we ever complained about not having enough time? I swear.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the plan, to network, to infiltrate the writing community, and to get to work.
Okay. So how do you do that? Let's figure out how you infiltrate the writing community. So you're doing a kind of receptionist job somewhere. Are you living on your own, do you think?
I'm flat sharing. I'm definitely flat sharing or house sharing.
Okay. Who's your roommate or your flatmate?
Ah, that's a good question. I mean, just from my experience, they're probably some kind of expats like me. And they've probably come to LA for a similar reason, maybe to break into acting, right? Everyone wants to break into acting in LA. So I'm thinking my roommates are idealistic, wannabe actors.
Love it.
Ideally screenwriters, but I think I am slightly unusual as a Black woman trying to break into screenwriting in LA. So I'm not readily finding, you know, people like that, but I am finding a lot of wannabe actors. I'm hanging out with them, and I'm working to pay my bills, and I'm writing, and I think inevitably I end up in some kind of film school.
Cool.
Or screenwriting program, because I think that is the perfect way to infiltrate a writing community. It's actually really hard to infiltrate writing communities. And I'm speaking as somebody who has experienced this in New York, starting from scratch again. And the way you do it is to actually build your own writing community from the bottom up. You meet other writers who are just starting out and don't know anyone.
Where do you meet them?
You meet them at writing schools, whether right. they're evening courses or day courses. And then you guys start supporting each other, checking in with each other, having regular meetups, reading each other's work and giving each other feedback. And over time, you become friends and you move through life together. And some people fall off and some people keep going and some people give you access that they have, share their access with you and share their information with you. And, you know, eventually you'll meet agents and eventually you'll meet directors. And the actors you lived with, eventually they get parts and eventually you write parts for them. Mm. Because actors like to be nice to writers because they want roles. Although actors are very annoying socially, but other than that, because they suck up all the oxygen in the room, it's like what they have to do is they have to like be charismatic and like memorable. And that's just like super annoying from a writer point of view. But that's my life in LA is being friends with annoying actors who I love deeply and gathering my writing community, like the hardcore people who are going to be like, we're going to meet at an all-night cafe and we're going to write from 10 till 2. And we're going to just survive on bagels. And bagels with no salmon, and, you know, and coffee. And we're going to brag about how much coffee we've drunk that day and how many words we wrote. And, you know, and we're going to all be super motivated. And eventually some of us are going to start getting hits, right? Some of us are going to get films made and, you know, and that's basically how it's going to go.
Let's think about you. Do you get something made?
I hope so. I mean, one thing which I realized in New York especially is that I have struggled with ADHD my whole life. I think it's partly why I moved from job to job a lot during my 20s. I got bored easily. I sometimes didn't perform well at work because I was bored. I was asked to leave a couple of places.
So is your concern that you, because of your ADHD and a sort of inability to focus or stay with something, that it would be hard to see a script or a screenplay to completion?
Yeah, I think it definitely needed an understanding that I have ADHD and I have to work a certain way in order to produce good work. It's an ongoing struggle. I definitely think when I came to New York, so it took me like 6 years to write The Niger Wife, and most of that in New York. When I came to New York,
can I just ask really quickly, was it Lagos to New York? Did you leave Lagos?
Yes. Yes. I left Lagos and moved straight to New York because my husband is a Nigerian and American.
Right. Okay.
So being in New York, I think the first thing I was able to do was sort of tackle my depression. And I realized also at the time, because my children were getting older, that one of my children had ADHD. And that was noticed by his school. And I realized through his diagnosis that I was neurodivergent. So that's typical late diagnosis that a lot of adults have been going through. And then I started taking medication, which really changed everything for me because it made me realize that I have been like struggling with this all my life. You know, my attention issues were noted in my secondary school report also, which devastated me at the time because I was so academic and I really wanted to do well and I thought I had done well. And to have that noted in my secondary school report, that attention to detail will always be her besetting worry, I thought that was so damning and I cried my eyes out.
Oh, no.
But now I think it's kind of validating that I actually did have issues. I wasn't crazy. And actually, I can be proud of myself for, you know, for getting a law and French law degree, for doing all these amazing things, writing two YA novels and all these plays, even though I was struggling with ADHD the whole time. I think motherhood was really like a wrecking ball into my writing, which is also why I didn't write for so many years, because that multitasking was just became impossible, even with help. You're pulled in so many different directions as a mother, and you have to be so attentive to small children. So I really didn't have the bandwidth for anything else, but coming to New York, getting some help, having that awareness of, okay, I can't just expect the work to happen like normal people do. I have to be super intentional about the way I work. And that really changed my habits and has enabled me to be a lot more productive.
Practically, what does that mean?
So it means that, first of all, if I work at home, I must have a place to work which is away from any people or any distractions. So from initially, that meant that I have to wake up at 5 a.m. and I have to do my work 2 hours before my kids wake up for school. So that's when I wrote most of the Niger Wife was between 5 and 7. Then while they were at school, I was able to do a little bit more work, but it was lower quality. But I've already done a solid 2 hours work. The second thing I would do is I would have a writing goal. So my writing goal remains 1,000 words per day. So having something measurable, and a lot of literary writers, I'm sure, would be very contemptuous of having a word count goal. But having that goal means that you can finish a long form project like a novel. I have had to take medication. So I've taken medication pretty much consistently since my diagnosis, which has helped me to not just write for more time. So now, for example, I can write all day, maybe, or for like 5 hours, 6 hours in a stretch. But it's also helped me to even feel like I can do this. It's helped me to feel more confident. I think that extra hit of dopamine helps me feel more positive and helps me feel like I can take on a little bit more. I can multitask. I can be sociable. I can be positive. I can open bills, and I can tackle this horrendous pile of laundry. And the doing it has helped me do it, if you see what I mean. It's almost like a muscle memory. Like I've been doing this consistently. So I know I can do this tomorrow. I can do this today. And so I think I would have been on that journey in LA. I would have hit a wall with my writing, and I would have had to figure out how I get over that wall. The good thing about Americans is they love medication. So nobody's going to gaslight you about wanting or needing medication.
Absolutely. It's our favorite. All the pills you could ever possibly desire.
Yes. And Americans are also more positive than Brits. And they're also more goal-oriented than Brits. You are never shamed for having a lofty goal in America. And in the UK, you are, because, you know, you're supposed to not show too much emotion. It's sort of frowned upon, and everybody's supposed to stay in their lane. In the UK, there's a rigid class system, and that extends to everything, which is that just be happy where you are. And that's why I like America at the moment, because I'm in a time of my life where I want to do more and I want to have lofty goals.
Yeah.
And I want to work hard, and I don't want to be told to stay in my lane or be happy where I am. I want to be encouraged, and I want someone to say, yeah, me too. And I want someone to say, and how can I help? And who can I call for you, or send me your work, you know? And that is very New York right now.
And I think probably quite LA. So you're there, you hit a wall, but you find, we're saying, you're going to find some help. You're going to probably find a psychiatrist. You're going to find some friends who really want to see you thrive.
Yeah.
And you push through.
Yeah. I get a job on a show, right? A writing job. And that's my first step to being Shonda Rhimes. Now, I don't think I could ever be Shonda Rhimes, because her work ethic is insane. And I don't even know that I want to work like that. You know, I'm still a go with the energy person. And so that means that, you know, you have to be sort of open to other things. I think I'm someone who wants to have relationships, and I want to give time to my friends and be sociable and go to parties and go hiking in LA and, you know, find out where the Kardashians go for lunch and then go there for lunch and like people watch and see who comes in. Like, I think I want to do all that stuff too. So I don't think I'm a Shonda. I don't think I'm going to ever be as successful as Shonda in that way. But I do eventually get a job on a show. writing for TV. I think I can do that.
Also, I love that, like knowing what your ambition levels, because that is, I mean, the flip side of America is that like manic, insane level of work that blots out the sun and allows for nothing else. So in a way, this is quite a nice hybrid of your American and UK sides to a certain extent, right? So there's
Totally.
This is how big I want it to be. And that feels good to me. It doesn't need to be gigantic, but also I don't want to be small. Okay. So what's the show? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it Succession? Are you writing for Succession?
Oh,
no, you
God.
Can't be, because it's like 2015 or something now.
I know. I mean, I think something like Succession is in my future.
Okay.
My future now. I think it takes a long time to get there. I think it takes a long time to get to the big ideas. So I definitely think there's a drama. I definitely think there's a rom-com. And then hopefully something like I branch into maybe sci-fi or politics, because I've always enjoyed politics. And that's where I hope I'm getting to the big ideas. I think I'm still writing novels, because I think that's just in me. So I'm probably writing a novel set in LA, because I love places. And I must add the caveat that I've never been to LA, but I feel like, because I've watched a lot of, what's it called? Selling Sunset. I think there's something so distinctive about LA and the LA personality. And again, it's a kind of place that changes people. So people go to LA, and then a few years later, the body modifications have begun. So, you know, I think that's incredibly fascinating. So I've probably written a novel about LA.
And body modifications, maybe.
Yeah, a person who has body modifications. You know, maybe I've even gone into real estate, because that's a good job you can do while writing, because you can choose your hours and make good money if you're sociable, which I am. So, and then you've got more people to write about, because you're getting to know all these weird and wonderful clients who have too much money. And their marriages are in trouble. You know, it's so I think maybe I've done that.
That's amazing. I'm so glad. I'm so glad you're writing about that. That's incredible. That's TV. That's fiction. That's anything you want it to be, really. Okay. Are you wearing impossibly high stiletto heels all the time? Because that's what they do in Selling Sunset, and I don't understand.
So the thing which I realized about Lagos versus London is that you can wear the stilettos because you never walk anywhere. You leave your apartment building, you step into your car, and you're driven wherever you need to go, and you get out of there and you go straight into another building, and usually it has seats. So you don't have to lug stuff anywhere. You don't have to walk around anywhere. I mean, this is pretty much as someone with privilege, obviously, but that's how most foreigners operate in Nigeria, partly also because there's a high kidnap risk, and especially if you're a foreigner. So walking is kind of frowned upon. And my husband would often tell me not to walk, because I love walking, but he'd tell me not to walk because he said, when you walk out of your compound, basically people can make a phone call and someone can meet you two streets down and kidnap you. It just takes a phone call. So he used to always tell me to drive, even if it was a short distance. So nobody walks in my circles. And so if you are driving and being driven, you can wear high heel stilettos. And I think it's the same concept for LA. LA is a drive around city. And if it's a drive around city and you drive to your straight to your destination, then you can wear the 6-inch stilettos.
Okay.
And that's why they do it. So maybe I would have worn the stilettos.
Now, I don't have you for very much longer, but there's one thing, if you can hang with me for a second, that we haven't touched at all, which I just want to touch on before I let you go and let you do your fabulous writing, if that's what you want to do. Do you think there's any romance during this period? Obviously, we have completely gotten rid of your husband. We've gotten rid of your children. Like, all of this is just you being you, doing your writing. Do you think anybody shows up, or are you just having a nice time being single and creative and wearing stilettos?
I mean, motherhood is something I always dreamed of since I was a teenager. I would happily have become a mother at 19. But I think I always had that as my central goal. And I think that being a mom has been amazing. And obviously, I love my kids to death. But I only recently, the last few years, had this idea of myself as a writer. And so I think for the purposes of this podcast, I want to dwell in that. I want to embrace an idea of being a Virginia Woolf, of being an Octavia Butler, of being a Zora Neale Hurston. I want to dive completely into my work and be obsessed by it and be obsessed by saying important things and creating a space for people like me that didn't exist before. And that for me is just as great as having children, if you can do that. So I withdraw from the world as I become more successful in LA. And I think about the big ideas, the complex novels that take a long time and take a lot of research. Maybe I become a professor or something, which helps me with my research. And eventually I write the big novel or the Succession, you know, the thing that will live on after me and say something about the world.
And is that in your real life? Do you feel like that's where you're headed? Do you want to have the big idea?
Yes, if I live long enough. I feel like every novel I write is a big idea for me, and it's more ambitious than what I was doing before. So everything takes me further towards that. I think for me to probably have that, I need either more age or more reading or more research. And definitely more time, because I still have a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old, and they need a lot of attention. I don't think 5 hours a day is enough for the big idea. I think it's got to be 22 hours. It's got to be eat, sleep, and dream the big idea for months at a time. And I feel like most of those sorts of writers, not all writers, but most of those sorts of writers are kind of obnoxious people who get to shut the door to other people's wants and needs. And I don't really think I'm in that space where I want to do that. But I'm curious about it. And perhaps now, if I live long enough, it's something for when my children have been able to move out into the world and have their own lives. And then I have more time to be selfish and to live in the kind of spaces you have to live in to produce that sort of work.
And in your unlived life, you're just going to squirrel yourself away and you're going to be in a library and you're going to write 22 hours a day.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be like Zora Neale Hurston, you know, I'll be traversing the South armed with a gun and doing my research, and I will be totally living in it. You know, she died poor and alone because she lived for her writing and that's all she wanted to do. And, you know, she's an incredible person on my sort of writing wall of fame. And yeah, that level of devotion, that level of being in it is what I I am giving in my unlived life.
I love that we've gotten to touch that for you. Shotgun and all. Hopefully, you know, you stay on the side of sanity, but I'm sure something massive comes out of it. And also, I think in your, you know, in your real life, because you have this mantra of going where the energy is and going where the joy is, I just wonder if there's a way of going really, whenever it happens, of going really deep into the big idea without totally destroying your relationships. I mean, it feels like it can't be impossible, but it requires.
It can't be impossible. I think it's very unlikely. I think that writing is dangerous. I think creativity is dangerous because you have to give so much emotionally, and the outside world sort of starts to disappear after a while. And that's where it gets dangerous. What you have to do to be creative, what you sacrifice, how you lose touch with reality, how you can lose touch with yourself. I think that's why writers are brave. Writing is not for the faint-hearted, no. Actually. And you want to write something important, then, you know, it comes from the person that you are, and it's a risk. Great writing, I do feel like it's like jumping off a cliff, and you hope you land safely, but you can't know where something will take you. When I wrote The Niger Wife, I was actually being quite brave because a lot of these questions were questions I actually had, and I didn't know if those were sane questions. I didn't know if being emotionally vulnerable was going to be good for me. I don't know if writing that book was where it was going to take me, but it was just, I didn't have any other way to be at that time, but I could not have prejudged that. I had no idea. I just had to keep writing until it was done.
Well, I think many, many people are really, really glad that you did, because it's an absolutely gorgeous book. Congratulations. And thank you for joining me on My Unlived Life. This was a joy.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much, Miriam. It's given me a lot to think about. Wow.
I'm so glad. That's the idea.
When listening back to my episode with Vanessa, one thing I was really struck by was the way that by trading Lagos for Los Angeles and her unlived life, she had swapped one place that, as she describes it, changes you for another. In the former, she described a rigid patriarchy that transformed her husband and frankly drove her into depression. In the latter, a simultaneously creative and superficial society that requires, as she put it, body modifications. Both of these worlds are opulent, grand, larger than life. And of course, both of them led to the wearing of ludicrously high stilettos. More importantly, in both scenarios, Vanessa was able to absorb, observe, and make art out of the external landscape she was in. In both worlds, though, it was her internal landscape, whether that be depression or an ADHD diagnosis, that drove small incremental change, changes in routine, in seeking community and finding acceptance, that led her back to life and into her next project. I would imagine that it's the ability to make these small internal changes, as opposed to any one city or landscape, that will one day lead her to that big idea that she's seeking. And given the internal strength she's found along the way, I'm still confident that she won't necessarily need to go full Zora Neale Hurston, shotgun and all, to find it. If you're a fan of My Unlived Life, I'd be so grateful if you'd help spread the word by rating, reviewing, subscribing, or following wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, by sharing on social media. Thank you so much for listening.